This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Great to be here with you. Libby is taking a couple of days off to enjoy some post-birthday and holiday time. She will return for Free for All Friday on Friday. Well, how do you know you have influenza rather than just a bad cold? It is a simple question, but I suspect the answer will be much longer when we go to our doctors here in just a moment. Personally, I was just hit with something that took me down for a good 4 days. It wasn't a cold other than a little congestion. It was a low-grade fever that literally zapped all my energy, left me sleeping on and off the whole time. Could it have just been a mild version of the flu or a mild version of COVID, given that I got both my vaccines back in late October? We know that this year's flu is hitting small children particularly hard, with 3 deaths in eastern Ontario attributed to influenza. That is just tragic. And what about you? Our phones are still not working due to ongoing technical challenges, but you can text the Fight Back team at 866-740-4740, and producer Kevin will send me the messages so I can read them on the air.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
Without further ado, Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Nadia Alam, a family doc and anesthetist in Georgetown, Ontario. Dr. Alam is running a little bit behind. She will join us here in just a few minutes. Dr. Razak, Dr. Moore, welcome. Thank you.
Hi, James.
Great to be with you.
Well, let's start, Dr. Razak, by talking about the different variants of the flu and COVID that are out there.
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is really the rapid surge of flu season. So if you look at Canadian data, more than 1 in 5 of all tests that are being done for flu now are coming back positive. That means we're right in the midst of that rapid surge that can crest at even 30 or 35%. It means there's an enormous amount of virus floating around. It is almost all influenza A, and specifically this subtype H3N2 that you've heard about in the news is the one that is the dominant strain in Canada. Why it matters is that we know historically that that tends to transmit more between people. It used to affect predominantly the elderly, but we are seeing this year because of a specific clade that has emerged, it's called clade K of H3N2, that more children are being impacted. And that has led to some of these tragic stories we heard, especially the 3 deaths. The important thing to recognize is that the protection of the vaccine, even with this clade and even with what's circulating, remains very, very strong, especially against severe disease or dying from flu. So again, really encouraging as we head into the holiday season that people go and get vaccinated. Rates of vaccination have dipped since the pandemic, including for flu. Other things floating around include COVID. Rates are relatively low right now. And of course, the common cold, which is many, many different kinds of viruses that can give you the common cold.
Okay, so in terms of symptoms, then, Dr. Razak, and why children, young children, are being harder hit than even adults who are 80 and over, how bad are these symptoms to the point where children are having to be taken to hospital and in these 3 cases have passed away?
Yeah, again, incredibly tragic. My heart goes out to the family. I'm a parent of young children. I cannot imagine what that would feel like or how you would respond to a tragedy like that. Right now, the difference between the cold and the flu largely is something that cannot be distinguished based on just how you are feeling. However, flu generally is more severe, so more fast in terms of symptom onset, more severe fever, more severe fatigue. Generally, people will have much more difficulty, especially if they are unvaccinated, with just routine daily function, like having enough food, getting enough sleep, things like that will be very hard with a bad case of the flu. The common cold generally does not hit people that hard. But like I said, there's a pretty wide spectrum. And again, to emphasize, even if you've had the flu vaccine, you can get the flu. It just tends to it tends to markedly reduce the severity of symptoms. So for example, if you had received the flu vaccine and you still got an infection, it could potentially feel more like just a common cold. You are sick, weather, but it's relatively mild. Now, in terms of protecting ourselves, the most important thing is getting vaccinated. It tends to take 2 weeks to get to maximum effectiveness. But even if you went out today and got protected, it would help you over the holiday season. So if you haven't done it, please go out and do it. Now, on the child front, in terms of protection, so the people who tend to get the most severe disease are the young and older individuals. Giving the example of children, by some estimates, more than 90% of all children who end up dying with influenza are not vaccinated. So that, again, is the big gap in protection. You know, and I like to draw the analogy to seatbelts. We put on our seatbelts. We know they're not perfect, but we know that if you get into a really bad car accident, they're going to provide you a layer of protection. Think about vaccines that way. They're not perfect, but they give you a very strong layer of protection against the worst outcomes.
I think we just heard Dr. Alam joining us, Dr. Nadia Alam, family doc, anesthetist in Georgetown, Ontario. You missed some of the beginning of our conversation, doctor, but Dr. Razak was just going through the various variants that are out there of the flu. What are you seeing in your office?
Oh my gosh. Ironically, I just saw a patient who I suspect has the flu. We have been swamped, and it's not just family medicine, it's the ER. Some ERs have even stopped testing for influenza because it's just so prevalent now. And I agree with Dr. Razak. If you haven't been vaccinated, do it as soon as possible. Remember, it takes a couple of weeks for it to really kick in. So you need to avoid people who are sick during that time to give your body the best chance of protection. And remember, flu shots are now so accessible, right? You can get them at pharmacies. You can get them at your family doctors. There are so many opportunities to be able to get the flu shot. But in terms of prevalence, oh my God, it is everywhere. It is the one of the highest respiratory, reason, one of the most common reason for admission because of respiratory illness now.
Wow.
And admission to hospital. So people are getting really sick from the flu. I know it whipped through our household.
Was it the actual flu, Dr. Alam, that went through your household? Because I'm guessing everybody was vaccinated.
We hadn't had a chance to get the vaccine.
Okay.
I was a bad mom.
No, you're not a bad mom. It's just, it's busy.
I was a bad mom. And I had the appointment booked, but we already got it.
Right. Well, that's going to make a lot of other people feel better out there if you were if you were still waiting to get them. And obviously, your intention would be to get the vaccines. Dr. Moore, you're dealing with immunocompromised people all the time as a cancer specialist. But how important are the vaccines, the COVID and the flu vaccines, for people who are going through cancer treatment?
Yeah, so it is true that the flu this year has targeted younger people more than usual, but the real vulnerable population are the immunocompromised, like the cancer patients, or people who live in long-term care facilities. They've always been the vulnerable ones. And there's no question that, you know, this is just a bad year. School absence rates, I mean, the way this is tracked in the population are school absence rates, and school absence rates in some provinces are above 10%, so which is much higher than usual. And maybe I could give one non-scientific observation. I took my grandkids to a Christmas show in Theater Orangeville on the weekend, which was excellent, by the way, and I was amazed by how much coughing, sneezing, and sniffling was going on in the audience. And so obviously we're all being exposed all the time. So you can't reduce exposure by totally seconding yourself. So really vaccinations are the only realistic way people can reduce their risks at this point.
Right. So different from COVID, when we literally had to be apart from other human beings. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's so prevalent, and there's so much human interaction going on, particularly around the holidays, that to think that by just masking and sort of secluding yourself, you're going to be exposed. So to reduce your risk, vaccination's the right approach.
And that is a whole lot better than what we were dealing with in 2020 and 2021, when we literally had to isolate ourselves with our little bubble of people who we lived with or perhaps worked with. Dr. Razak, back on that note about COVID, what do we know about the COVID that is going around right now? Because, I mean, I only have my own example to draw from, but the symptoms that I had from Thursday through Monday were very much like the COVID I had, but after four shots. So it wasn't like a severe illness. It was just, it just made me feel like all I wanted to do was sleep.
Yeah, so there is not nearly as much COVID going around right now as influenza. Certainly some people are getting sick. I did see a case in hospital, but we're nowhere near where we were early in the pandemic. I mean, it was a crisis then. I think we have to recognize how far we have come. Many people have many rounds of vaccines now. Many went out and got this year's version, especially those who are high risk. And I think it's worked. We are seeing much less severe disease. And what we are seeing, though, is more of a rebound. You know, it was fascinating. During the first year of the pandemic, because of the social distancing, because of the mask wearing, the limited encounters, we saw the lowest rates of influenza in Canadian history. Globally, we saw the lowest rates. There was one year where there was no child hospitalized with influenza across the country. I mean, that is astounding. So, of course, the same things that prevent COVID spread prevent RSV spread, prevent influenza spread, prevent cold spread. But that is not how a society can function. You can't have isolation like that. We are social beings. So I think to Malcolm's point, vaccine is that base level of protection. And then being a good citizen, being a good colleague, being a good friend, being a good fellow Canadian, if you're really sick, don't go to a play and cough over 20 or 30 other people. Mm-hmm. We had the great privilege of being at a resort with our kids last week in a way. There was a lot of people sick there, and they were coughing all over the food. And I was looking at it, I was like, oh God, please, no, you know, but it's that kind of thing. That it's what we can do to reduce spread among each other. And, you know, ultimately, no one wants to miss their holidays, miss time with family. But if you do go into that day when you're really infectious and you infect everyone and grandma and grandpa, you know, that's pretty consequential if you do that. So, you know, just use your judgment.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the good things that came out of COVID, that we have become much more aware of our own symptoms and how they will ultimately affect other people. I mean, Dr. Alam, you know, before COVID, you were considered heroic if you went into work and you weren't feeling well because you were a trooper. I think that's the way we used to describe people. But really, you're more of a trooper and more of a team player if you don't go to work.
Yeah, and I agree, Jane. It's been a real change in mindset. Now, there are some things that make it more challenging, right? It's not just that mindset of suck it up, buttercup. I'm glad that's changing. I'm glad people are saying, you know what? If you're sick, your focus should be on recovering and also protecting those around you. But there are groups of people where that becomes really difficult. I have a number of patients. My colleagues have a number of patients. We've all had patients or know of people who do suffer from financial hardship, who do suffer from income insecurity, job insecurity, housing insecurity. To miss work for them can be not just difficult, but actually mean the difference between whether or not they can buy groceries that week. And so when we protect people by being careful ourselves, getting our vaccines, following rules around hand washing and segregating when we're ill, we prevent the spread to populations that are not as privileged as us.
Yeah, that is a good reminder.
That is a part of being a really good citizen.
Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that and you know what? And that is reminiscent of the early days of COVID as well, yep. when people, yep. hourly workers, had to keep going to work despite the fact that COVID was out there, because if they didn't go to work, they didn't get paid. So that is an important reminder. So for those of us who are salaried, who have sick days, stay home and protect those who don't have those luxuries. There was a new poll just out this morning, convenient for our conversation here with the medical record panelists. And by the way, it is Jane for Libby here on Zoomer Radio's Fight Back, Dr. Nadia Alam, Dr. Malcolm Moore, Dr. Fahad Razak. Three quarters of Canadian adults still have varying levels of confidence in vaccines. Hesitancy has increased over the last 5 years, but that's 75% number. Dr. Moore, I find that to be quite heartening.
Yeah, you know, I think it's time to stop dividing the universe into vax and anti-vax, because I don't think it's, I think it's more nuanced than that. To give you an example that's a bit different, immunotherapy is now a very effective cancer therapy, and lots of lives have been saved, lung cancer, skin cancer, from the use of immunotherapy, where you rev up the immune system to fight the cancer. Having said that, there are some really significant side effects from revving up the immune system, these non-specific immune effects that can be quite serious. And in the cancer context, it's still worthwhile to do it. And I think we do have to acknowledge that with vaccinations, there's clear evidence of benefit in a number of diseases, but there are also side effects. And so rather than sort of, you know, demonizing people who are more skeptical about vaccinations, I think we have to be open about the data surrounding individual vaccines. And I think, you know, If the population started to believe that routine mumps, measles and rubella vaccination was a bad thing, that would be a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. But so I think we just need to be open about the fact that any medical intervention has some degree of side effects and toxicities. Be as open as we can about what those are, and then understand that the weight of evidence for almost all the common vaccines is that the benefit outweighs the risks.
Dr. Razak, do you want to jump on that? Being the former scientific director of the COVID advisory panel, this is right up your alley.
Yeah, look, so to Malcolm's point, I think the divisiveness around vaccines, and frankly, although Canada was late to the game, it did become a significant political issue here, was hugely destructive to what I would hope would be largely treated as an under-the-radar, non-political public health preventative approach, which is how we should think about it. You know, I always think about seatbelts as an analogy. As I said earlier, there's these things that people have gotten used to doing to help reduce risk. We do it in all parts of our life. It's not just vaccination. And vaccines fit, to me, philosophically the same framework. There's a reason you get insurance. There's a reason you wear seatbelts. It's about prevention. We live in a world that is ever safer, largely, than it was 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. A lot of that is through systematically reducing risk where we can, and vaccines are part of it. Now, where I think we stumbled sometimes is we were, and I'm going to look at myself, and I'm going to say early in the vaccine rollouts, was I more firm than I should have been about, you must get this, you have to do it, it's your responsibility, society? Yes, I think there's a lot of learning for those of us who we're messaging it. I think there is a lot of nuance. But at the same time, you can also see a situation where, for example, we lose our vaccine elimination status this year for a disease that, where the vaccine has been studied for 50 years, is overwhelmingly safe. There are complex reasons why that happens, but clearly there's been a breakdown in acceptance of an overwhelmingly safe vaccine for children. And so you can see there are both sides here. There is, I think, too confident messaging by those in the medical establishment, people like myself And I think we're trying to learn from that. There's also a pull away from some areas where I think the evidence for safety and benefit is overwhelming. So I do think that there is an opportunity to reinforce those kind of baseline protections in a way that there has been clearly some erosion.
Yeah, because long before COVID arrived, even, you know, when we were vaccinating our children before COVID, when I was vaccinated as a child, when you were all vaccinated, it was the thing to do. You got the MMR vaccine for your kids when they were 2 months old. You gave them a little shot of Tylenol. You didn't really question it. And nobody, like Dr. Alam, I remember, you know, this is 30 years ago, but nobody in my friend group was saying, oh, I don't believe in the vaccines. Like, this feels like something new that maybe is a backlash to COVID. Who knows?
I agree, Jane. I think, like, even prior to the vaccines or during the time of COVID when the vaccines were released, there was a paper done where they talked about planning for a COVID-19 vaccination program. They talked about how 84% of Canadians trusted their family physician's advice on vaccination. That trust has slowly gone down. And I agree with you. I think it's new. It is a change in environment. I think the thing that I struggle with, so I agree with the nuanced approach that Dr. Moore and Dr. Razak are talking about. I agree with not demonizing parents who are trying to make the best decisions possible for their kids. I don't know, and I struggle with this. I don't know how to navigate the fact that parents are getting their information not just from vetted sources, but also from completely unvetted sources. This rise of misinformation and disinformation has left me struggling. And while I remain non-judgmental in my discussions with my patients, I always talk to them and say, tell me if I'm coming across too hard, but help me understand why this resource, why you believe this resource more than this other one.
Yeah.
It always comes down to them knowing someone. Yes, they trust right. my advice. They will say, you're my family doctor. I believe you. I'm never going to tell you how to do your job. But they really trust, and we saw this during COVID too, they really trust information from people they know or people who know people whom they know, right? And so that sways them a lot. And then those stories of side effects, of complications, real or perceived, because remember, just because someone has a complication, it isn't necessarily related to the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear this a lot about people who get flu shots. Oh, I don't get the flu shot anymore because I got the flu the last time I got the flu shot.
Right. We
Not
heard
realizing
that.
Realizing that it takes time to take effect.
Yes, yes. We heard that all the time.
Challenging.
Before COVID.
Yeah.
That was the line that a lot of people used.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not getting the flu shot because it's going to give me the flu.
And Jane, can I add, I think that there is also a loss of memory among people in general of bad diseases look like. Like if you talk to our parents and grandparents generation, my dad had smallpox. At that time, the mortality rate was 1 in 3 children who got smallpox died. And all a parent could do was keep them in quarantine with a caregiver who had survived smallpox and was now immune. And you would hope that a few weeks later, your child would be alive and come out of that room. That's all you could do. So parents routinely lost children to infectious disease. None of us largely, fortunately, now know of a personal example where a friend, a colleague, a family member has lost a child to a disease. So we're living in a world that is where the benefits of all of those protections are no longer a day-to-day realization. Because you don't know the alternate.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is part of the story here. People fixate on what I would say often are relatively minor or not well scientifically established side effects they heard from somebody to somebody that someone felt bad after a vaccine. And we don't know of those personal examples anymore of how catastrophic these illnesses are. And that is what is shifting the scales in many ways.
Yes, because we don't, you know, if you want to compare it to, and Dr. Moore, I'll compare it to the young people of today have no idea what their great-grandfather lived through fighting in a war. They have no experience. They have no know-how. They don't know what that feels like. And as a result of vaccines And having had those vaccines protect us from polio and rubella and measles and mumps, and I remember having measles and mumps as a child, they don't think about the possibility for anything bad to happen to them because of the society that we've lived in, which has protected them. Dr. Moore, I'll just your comment on that.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, my grandfather was one of nine children, and I think five survived. I mean, there was a time when that's what happened. And, that's unimaginable to us now. But, 70, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, that's kind of what was happening. So I think Fahad's given a very good point. The current experience of people is such that these things aren't really a problem anymore. But they're still, as we've learned from the measles epidemic, they're still here. It's just we've, for the most part, until recently, we've all been protected.
We just have time for a final comment. I'll go to Dr. Razak about that. As part of this Leger poll, it went to how many people? Something like 1,700 people. But they also spoke with healthcare providers. And the concerns driving vaccine hesitancy, some of which you have all been talking about, safety, 61% say they're worried about the safety of vaccines. Misinformation from social media influencers, 53%. And mistrust in institutions at 48%. But Dr. Razak, even though you feel like maybe you were a little too hard line, you have the expertise of years and years and years of schooling and practice. And why wouldn't we believe you over somebody on TikTok?
I mean, I hope you would believe me. What I'm saying is that I think my personal reflection is the need for more humbleness and meeting people where they are in communication in a way that I, as someone who was not media trained, was in a position of making statements over and over again, many days on end. And I look back at some of the ways that I said things and I think I could have done better. So it's a personal reflection on trying to meet people where they are, but not undercutting that. Yes, I have spent 20 years doing this job. And I believe in a car mechanic to manage my car. I believe in an airline pilot to fly the plane that I take on vacation. And hopefully people will trust us as physicians and people in public health and in this area when we make recommendations, the same way that I often and confidently turn over decision making to other people for other parts of daily life where I have no experience, expertise in. Like I hope this is the kind of society we can live in. What you're highlighting, Jane, is a general erosion in trust and expertise. It is across the board. Obviously, we're talking about it in a medical context, but it is part of a larger trend in society, which is the erosion in belief in knowledge, science, expertise, judgment, and looking for alternate ways to get information. That is a broader, big, ugly problem we are dealing with right now.
Right. Okay, we will leave it there. I think you were all heroic during the COVID-19 crisis. And Dr. Razak, you provided a lot of comfort and reassurance for so many of us. So I appreciate your reflections. But honestly, you really were a lifesaver for so many of us, providing all of that information when we were so uncertain about what was happening in the world. Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks for those
kind words. Stay safe.
All right. Yes, be safe, everybody. Dr. Malcolm Moore there, medical oncologist, Princess Margaret Cancer Center, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at U of T, and Dr. Nadia Alam, family doctor and anesthetist in Georgetown, Ontario. It is Jane for Libby, and coming up in the second half of Fight Back, right after this break, the top food stories that shaped Canada's food system in 2025. That is next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
We did get some texts from you toward the end of our segment there with the doctors, but we need to move along. Just a reminder, our phones are not yet back up and working. We have a crack technical team working around the clock and through the weekends to deal with these technical issues that we've been experiencing for almost 2 weeks now. But you can text us anytime at 866-740-4740. You don't need a one, just 866-744-740 if you have some thoughts or input on whatever it is we are discussing here on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer, who will be back on Friday, by the way. Well, unlike traditional year-end rankings focused on headlines or viral moments, the 2025 list from the Agri-Food Analytics Lab emphasizes the structural forces shaping food affordability, consumer trust, and system resilience. And who better to explain what made the list and why? Our friend Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University and co-host of the Food Professor podcast. Sylvain, hello.
Good afternoon.
So how did you go about compiling this list?
Well, as a lab, we actually, from day one, every year, we track news items, things that are significant, things that are covered by the media, and things that are significant aren't always covered by the media, by the way.
Fair enough.
Compile all, yeah. But well, I mean, media is media, right? You're so busy covering everything. When it comes to food, there's so much you can do with the time that you have. So we try to, you know, compile some of the things that can or will or has impacted food systems in general. And what I mean by food systems, mm-hmm. We're talking about food affordability, politics, geopolitics, companies, scandals, things like that. Of course, media will always focus on scandals.
it's true than us,
which is fine. I mean, it's fair, but we always try to understand why is this a scandal? Like why this story resonated with Canadians and media, while the other one, which sometimes I mean, there's some stories in the food business that are scandalous, but aren't necessarily covered. And so we try to understand why. So this list tries to capture the essence of what 2025 was all about when it comes to food in general.
Okay, yeah. And just from the media perspective, a lot of times a story that you may release will get a lot of coverage or very little coverage depending on what else is happening on the planet that particular day, right? It just depends on the news cycle. And sometimes we eat up the stuff that you send out. Like when I saw this list, I thought, oh, what a great topic for Fight Back. So I'm glad that we're spending some time going back over the year that was in terms of the top food stories. So
yeah, and it's always a fun topic every year. I think media has it's always nice to reminisce and reflect on the year that's been, and often we talk about items, things that have happened, and people forgot that it was this year.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm just in the process of doing two year-end specials, one of which is going to air in this time slot on Boxing Day and the other one on January 1st. And I go back and I'm looking at content from February, March, and I'm reminded, oh, yeah, that's right. That was a big deal for a week or two, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then yeah, absolutely.
Right. So we need to be reminded. So let's go through the list. I think it makes sense to go from 10 to 1. Is that like in terms of importance?
Exactly. So from 10 to 1 in importance. But the way that we write our report, we start with 10 going down to 1, just like a countdown.
Yep. Okay. So number 10, Crown Royal Theatrics.
That happened in your own backyard in Ontario.
Yes.
With Doug Ford pouring forever a bottle of Crown Royal. And we thought it was a really important moment because, of course, the premier was upset with the fact that Diageo, the owner of Crown Royal, was closing a plant in Windsor, Ontario, a bottling plant which serviced the American market. But I suspect that most people looking at that clip didn't realize that that bottle was actually made in Manitoba and bottled in Quebec. And that was not going to change. And so what was really ironic is that most people thought that Crown Royal was leaving Canada. And so, and he was asking, you know, he was encouraging people to reconsider their relationship with Crown Royal and any Diageo products. And that would include a slew of different products like Bailey's, for example, and Smirnoff and all these products. And frankly, I think it pointed to how Premier Ford didn't really understand supply chains and how it could impact optics and in general. And it was all about emotions and theatrics, of course.
Oh, yes.
Going against Donald Trump and tariffs.
Yes. So what did he have right in that moment? I mean, a facility leaving Windsor was certainly noteworthy. It just, I guess he was using the wrong.
He was basically encouraging Ontarians to boycott a product made by unionized workers in both Manitoba and Quebec.
Right.
I mean, basically, and I think the whole thing, other than the fact that he was upset, and it was absolutely appropriate for him to register his disappointment in the company. The company's decision to go south actually made business sense. Really, but they weren't giving up. The company was not giving up on Canada. It was just giving up on that one plant in Windsor, because that plant in Windsor happens to service only the United States, and that's it.
You call it optics over outcomes. Okay, number 9, the disappearance of iconic candies. You mentioned Cherry Blossom. I remember that so well. It was one of my favorites. And Jersey Milk. And Jersey Milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was this year. Are you still mourning the loss of Cherry Blossom?
No. No.
You know, that bar was 120 years old.
Was it? I have fond memories, nostalgia of enjoying it for as long as I could as a small child.
Oh, my God. It was created in Canada. But this is the reason why Cherry Blossom was a bit of a disappointment is because it was actually created in Canada. It was sold off to an American company, went to the U.S., and, of course, Canadians lost sight of or lost control of the brand itself. And because it wasn't being sold. It wasn't marketed at all. I mean, I remember the day it was announced. I went to a convenience store, bought the whole box, and the clerk told me, "Oh, we're still selling those?"
Yeah,
that's a bad sign. So you could tell that the brand itself really was losing touch and wasn't really part of the food marketing that we see today. And Jersey Milk is the same thing. And so we lost quite a few products this year just because they became American, quote unquote, and we lost them forever.
A cultural story driven by hard economics. Okay, that's what you say about that. And number 8, yep. Buy Canadian and maple washing.
Yeah, I'm sure you've noticed that when for a while there, when you went to the grocery store, it was Canada Day every day.
Yes.
Like there were maple leaves everywhere and people were looking for that maple leaf, which is great. But we also saw grocers taking advantage a little bit of the momentum by displaying Canadian oranges or Canadian almonds and things like that. So there was a lot of maple washing going on. So I thought it was a really important story for this year. People, you know, going after Canadian products. And there are some success stories out there for sure. Canadian products that have done very well with the Buy Canadian movement. But we're seeing signs that it's slowing down, unfortunately. But this is certainly one story that caught our attention this year.
Yeah, it became a religion there for a few months, literally.
That's right. Exactly.
Number 7, meat counter economics. What do you mean by that?
Oh my goodness. Well, it all started with beef. Beef is very expensive, but people shifted over to chicken and pork, and guess what's happening? Well, both are more expensive now. And so There is some disappointment around chicken because chicken is supply managed in Canada. We're not supposed to be seeing increases of 20 to 30% in chicken because prices are supposed to be stable. But they're not talking about that. But I do think that meat prices at the grocery store were a big story this year, and a lot of people were talking about it.
Oh, yeah. We've seen it. Number six, the GST holiday. Oh, yeah, that was way back at the beginning of the year. And the debate on making it permanent.
Do you remember that our food inflation rate in January was at minus 0.6%?
Right.
So you could see that the GST holiday made a difference. Food was actually costing less for a while.
From the January before.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So from the January before, food was actually cheaper just because of the GST holiday. And I think it opened up the door to discussions about a permanent holiday. I know the Restaurants Canada is pushing for that, and a lot of people are actually pushing for that too. So I think it really made for an interesting debate. And of course, we have some interesting data because we saw how the market would react without taxes on food. And for people out there who don't know this, but we do tax a lot of food in retail too. We pay for over $2 billion worth of taxes at the grocery store. And it's not just bad food. It's actually food that was shrinkflated. So for example, if you buy six muffins, these are some of the ridiculous policies we have. Six muffins, not taxable because it's food. Four muffins, that's taxable.
Right.
Same muffins.
Right. Number five, GLP-1s transforming food demand. You're talking
Ozempic effect.
Yes, the Ozempic effect.
Yeah, Wegovy. Yep. 2 million people in Canada now are on a GLP-1 drug.
No kidding.
Solely to lose weight.
Wow.
Solely to lose weight, yeah. And that number is growing. And starting January 1st, we'll see generic drugs that are going to be a third of the price. So we're expecting demand to go up again.
More people
It changes it, yeah.
More people
are drinking less alcohol.
Yep.
They're snacking less.
Yep.
Eating less sodium, less sugar. It's actually impacting the food industry. Hmm. Absolutely.
But it is good for the individual if it works for them.
I can't comment on that. Yeah. I know that I've spoken to some medical doctors and the public health, I would say, group is questioning the usage of GLP-1s. And we don't go there. We don't comment on that. We're just trying to assess exactly how that phenomena is impacting food in general.
Yeah, that makes sense. Number four, the cloned meat disaster.
You covered that story, I think. Your station covered that story. That was a disaster from Health Canada. Health Canada was about to approve clone meat as non-novel, so it wouldn't need approval, without really announcing it. they weren't planning to send out a press release or anything. And so we decided to out them back in October. We wrote a piece in the for Post Media, and media just picked it up. It went viral. People got upset. And Health Canada decided to pause the process, the approval process. So, but this, I think, points to how consumers are fed up with the lack of transparency. I think people deserve and want more transparency from both regulators and the food industry.
Yes. We're in the home stretch here. Number three, tariffs and counter tariffs hitting food prices.
Tariffs are a bad idea.
Yeah.
And it started with, obviously, the President of the United States. We actually applied counter tariffs on a lot of products, which actually impacted food inflation overall. It all ended in September, of course, on our side, with Prime Minister Carney eliminating all tariffs on food. And Donald Trump, without saying it, also made a mistake by applying tariffs on food. It's all gone now, but there's always a legacy with taxes, and typically it really pushes prices higher. So it was an unfortunate event this year, but to be honest, based on our data, it really made food more expensive, unfortunately.
Mm. Number two, grocer code of conduct finally established.
I'm so happy that there's some media coverage on the grocer code of conduct, despite the fact that it's a complicated issue. But I think that the media is doing a really good job covering the story. It's an important one. It will create a level playing field and more stability with food prices for consumers over time. And without going to the details of the conduct of the code itself, it will offer more support to processors out there dealing with grocers, overpowering grocers, and it will give them a chance to reach out to consumers and bring more competition to the market. And with more competition, typically you see more stable and lower prices.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, and as we all would have imagined, number one, structural food inflation crisis. We've been talking about it on and off all year.
Exactly. And frankly, I think a year ago, it was all about greedflation. People were pointing fingers at grocers. And I'm not saying it's not a factor, but I think that the discourse around inflation this year kind of changed. And people are starting to realize that our food inflation situation is much more complicated. It's not just cyclical or temporary. It's structural, meaning that we're dealing with poor logistics, supply management, interprovincial trade barriers, wacky labor rules between provinces, labels that are really complicated and cost. I mean, I could go on and on and on. A lot of things are making food more complicated, and it's not normal to see our food inflation rate being higher than America's when you have a president applying tariffs on everything, making inflation a much worse issue, but it isn't. So that means that our companies in Canada aren't able to absorb shocks, global shocks, and we need to work on that.
The top food stories of 2025, as just described by Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, the Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. I look forward to all of our conversations in 2026. Thank you, Sylvain.
Take care. Happy holidays.
Happy Bye-bye. Holidays. Coming up in the final segment of Fight Back, Jane for Libby, we welcome Ontario's Green Party leader, Mike Schreiner, as the Ontario Legislature begins a 14-week break. That's where we will start the conversation next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Ontario's Green Party leader calls it another example of the government ducking democracy, the 14-week winter break at the Ontario Legislature. To find out why and for a look back at the fall session and what it all means for Ontarians, Mike Schreiner joins us now on Fight Back. Mike, appreciate the time as always.
Hey, Jane, it's always a pleasure to join you.
So let's start with the elephant in the room, the 14-week break. I mean, clearly, you guys are still working. You're just not at the legislature necessarily.
Oh, yeah, Jane, we're still working, and we work really hard in our ridings. And, you know, as a party leader, I'm traveling across the province. But when we're facing the affordability crisis that's making life hard for so many people in this province, primarily being fueled by the housing crisis. I mean, housing starts are at historic lows, rents and housing costs are at historic highs. We need to get back to Queen's Park and pass some legislation so we can start building homes that people can afford in the communities they know and love, so we can actually bring in protections for renters, so we can fix the landlord tenant board to help both landlords and tenants. But instead, the Ford government doesn't want to answer the tough questions or be held accountable to the people of Ontario.
What is your feeling on question period and what takes place in the legislature? Because the outtakes we see and we hear, a lot of it is theater, and there's very little accountability taken on by a government, not just the current government, but a government, especially a majority government.
Well, you know, question period does have its performative aspects. There's no doubt about that, Jane. But there's also important questions that are asked, and the government is forced to answer those questions. And those of us in the opposition, when we, put those questions forward, they're really being driven by the questions people in Ontario are asking us to ask the premier. We also can't underestimate just the important work that happens in committees. Well, when the Ford government actually lets bills go to committees, or that happen in hallway conversations, the important work that we do when we're answering questions from the media. And you know what? The Ford government is just going to put all that on hold until almost the end of March. Mm. And this is so outrageous at a time when so many people are struggling to put a roof over their head and food on the table.
So help people understand, when there is a 14-week break at the Ontario legislature, no legislative business takes place. Is that right?
That's right. Now, committees can meet, but, you know, no bills are going to be passed. And there's so much that needs to be done. You know, like, we just need to legalize multiplexes and mid-rises to build homes that people can afford. We need to bring in protections for renters. We need to fix the landlord-tenant board to benefit landlords and tenants. We need to have the government actually start building deeply affordable homes again so we can start addressing this affordability crisis that's, you know, leading to an unprecedented number of people going to food banks, a 340% increase in the city of Toronto alone since the Ford government was elected, the unprecedented number of people experiencing homelessness in Ontario, over 81,000 people, so many full-time workers not able to find a place they can afford to pay rent in this province. There's a lot of pieces of legislation that if the government would say yes to it, we could actually get passed and start addressing this crisis. But instead, the premier wants to take a few months off.
So Government House Leader Steve Clark says about the 14-week break, it's important politicians go back to their ridings, hear from their constituents, and do work to implement the legislation they have passed, which would lead us to believe that there is a lot of work now to put into motion based on what was accomplished in the fall. But you're saying that's not the case.
Well, we certainly want to spend time, and I do spend time back in my riding, listening to my constituents, going to events, hearing the concerns that people and organizations have. But part of the reason we do that is so we go to Queen's Park and actually pass legislation that addresses the real concerns, especially when it comes to jobs and affordability in Ontario. But if the premier doesn't want Queen's Park to sit, then, you know, then we don't have as many opportunities to bring the voices of the people to Queen's Park to pass solutions to the problems they're facing. So I'm all for taking a couple months, listening to people, traveling around the province, spending time in my riding, but 14 weeks, that is irresponsible on the part of the Ford government. They don't want to be held accountable, and they really don't want to listen to the people of Ontario because they refuse to say yes to so many of the solutions that people are asking for.
How much do you think is related to the Skills Development Fund? And, I mean, all of you on the opposition benches seem to be on the same page about possible conflict of interest. Even Marit Stiles routinely calls it corruption.
Yeah, well, this is Greenbelt 2.0. It's the government putting the wealthy and well-connected ahead of what's good for everyday people. I think the premier wants to dodge responsibility and accountability for a fund that really was a good fund, designed to train workers, especially at a time when we're facing a jobs crisis brought on, you know, by this ridiculous trade war. But instead of, you know, spending that money on high scoring programs and proposals that would actually benefit workers, the money has gone to Ford connected insiders and organizations that hire Ford connected lobbyists. Also on the housing front, I mean, the premier, basically, when people came to Queen's Park and said, you know what, we need help with rent, the premier said to get a job. Well, I'm sorry, half the people going to food banks in Toronto come from households that have a job. One third of them have two jobs. People simply cannot afford to live in Ontario. We need to solve that at Queen's Park, and we need to have a little bit of time back in our ridings, but boy, we need to be back in February passing legislation to fix the problems that are making life less affordable and harder for the people of this province.
How likely, when you go back, are the Ford PCs willing to listen to the suggestions of the opposition and implement the solutions that you guys are coming up with?
Well, you know what? The fall sitting was certainly an indication that the government is not listening. It's why they didn't hold committee hearings, which gives the people of Ontario the opportunity to come and, you know, speak to legislation. But I don't want to discount the important conversations that take place across party lines when we're at Queen's Park and just how important it is. Like, I can't tell you how many, you know, ministers I've worked with where we may disagree on policy, but we come up with some solutions that work for our riding. We just had the housing minister in my riding yesterday, the day before, bringing some a check to help us unlock some housing by building housing infrastructure. A lot of those conversations that lead to things like that happen when we're at Queen's Park, but the premier would rather take 14 weeks off than actually have us working together to figure out some solutions to, you know, the affordability challenges that so many people are facing.
Well, that's good to hear that it is working a little bit on some level, which leads me to my next question, and we're basically out of time, but I do enjoy chatting with Mike Schreiner. You have an interesting phenomenon in the city of Guelph, as does Ashlyn Clancy, the other Green Party MPP in Kitchener Centre. Do the people of Guelph and Kitchener Centre have differing priorities than the rest of Ontarians, given that they're the only two ridings with Green MPPs?
Well, I tell you what, Jay, when people elect Greens, they must like them, because we're the only caucus that had our entire caucus get over 50% of the vote in our re-election. And I think it's because we punch well above our weight and we're willing to work across party lines to put the people of our riding ahead of partisan politics. And I think people in Kitchener and Guelph like that.
Well, very good. And on the Liberal leadership, the pending Ontario Liberal leadership, John Fraser has made it clear that as many times as he has stepped in to be interim leader, he's not interested in doing it full time. We all remember when there was a push to get you to change parties and lead the Liberal leadership. Any thoughts about a hybrid Liberal Green party?
No, I don't think so. I think people, we want to give voters plenty of choices, but I do think working cooperatively with the other opposition parties is something that's a high priority for the Green Party, and we'll continue to work across party lines with the Liberals and the NDP to bring forward solutions to the challenges people are facing.
All right, we will leave it there for this time. Mike, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, happy holidays. Always nice to chat.
Hey, all the best to you and your listeners, Jane.
Thank you. Mike Schreiner, leader of the Ontario Green Party. It is Jane for Libby. And tomorrow it will be Tasha Carradine for Libby. And she'll begin the discussion after the new news with the municipal panel, the Tune Into the Town panel, talking about the important news of this week here in Toronto. And have a great day. I'll talk to you tomorrow morning on the Morning Zoom with Andy and Jane.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.